You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 171, our 23rd Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Very good. Busy as usual, but having a pretty productive week.
Yeah. Well, Mike, it looks like Hebrews is going to run away with our poll on which book we cover next. Monday, I guess by the time you're listening to this episode, the voting will probably already be over, but it's such a landslide, 52-53% now. So I think we can pretty much call it and say Hebrews is going to be the winner.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I don't think anything's going to change in a few days.
No. Well, that's good. So back into the New Testament. And
I'm really surprised that Colossians was just sort of left in the dust, you know, even behind Jeremiah. So I'll confess I am surprised at the outcome, but it's pretty clear.
Yeah. I think Colossians is who I voted for the book I voted for.
Well,
we didn't win, Mike. I don't know if you voted, but we didn't win.
We didn't win. I didn't vote, but I was kind of hoping for Colossians. I think I could go in and just sort of set up a bot now and vote for Colossians from here over the next few days, and it's not going to make any difference. So
Maybe next time, since Hebrews is way shorter than Ezekiel and Leviticus, maybe Colossians will have a chance for the next vote, which will be sooner rather than later. Yeah. And speaking of winners, Mike, I just wanted to remind you and everybody out there, all of our listeners, Naked Nation, that I am still the current reigning champion of Naked Bible Fantasy Football, which is
I should go in and just change the name of your team to Colossians. That would be a metaphor for the year. You're gonna get married.
Don't think so. I know it's hard for you to admit that I am the champion, but
only because you bring it up all the time.
Well, hey, you know, I gotta say it why it's true, right? Because
you're gonna be intolerable if you repeat. I can already see that coming.
But. No, my reign is just starting, so just get used to it, folks.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, so I need to change my intro. So the layman champion. I might have to do that once football starts. So
I only want to hear that. So
speechless. I understand. Yeah. And, I render people speechless and winless all the time. So
it's a long season that hasn't even started yet. So.
And my Cowboys already starting off with some rough news. So I don't want to get into it right now. But
it's just bad.
It's disturbing. It's painful. But anyway, Mike, I want to remind everybody that next week I'm still accepting questions for the Melchizedek Q&A that we're going to be having next week. So there's still time to send me a question. I think the cutoff will be, I don't know, next week sometime, Friday maybe, or Thursday. I don't know. But if you have a question yet, just go ahead and send it in to me. We obviously can't answer everybody's questions. We'll be picking a handful, picking some questions that we didn't cover in those four episodes. So
we'll try to weed them out. We don't necessarily want repetition. We'll try to zero in on things that, weren't covered or not covered in much detail.
Yeah. Maybe something to add to the conversation and see if we can't find some of those. So continue to send me those questions at treystrickland@gmail.com. And I guess, Mike, we've got questions for this Q&A ready to go if you are.
Sure.
All right. Here we go. Our first question is going to be from Ryan. And his question is, if oral traditions are the norm, why are the dates of written documents important? Couldn't the stories have been known among the people already? When Mike and others use the dates of written documents, the conclusion appears to be the biblical text comes after. Is that a conclusion about the final edited form or the whole history of the story? I realize the original oral traditions are certainly more difficult to track down, but why do scholars tend to agree on the perceived order of the stories? Doesn't evidence exist that the stories share enough differences to indicate that each people had its own background and the final result may indicate later editing? If so, how do we apply inspiration to this scenario? And are all versions inspired or only the final version we now have?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me hit the last part of that first. Inspiration is really about the final form of the text. In other words, when that point at which God's providential oversight of the process, his oversight of the human hands forming the text, was completed. And that has to be the case because that's what we have. I mean, we don't have the Bible in stages, like to be able to look back at some earlier stage prior to the final form of the text, you know, the text as we have it. We can't just go look it up like, oh, let's go check the edits out. It's not like in Microsoft Word where you can review a document and see all the editorial changes. We don't have anything like that. So inspiration, again, properly talked about, really refers to the final product of the providential process. So to speak of inspiration applying to text that we don't have doesn't make any sense. So that's kind of the way it has to be. Now, you know, back to the beginning, this whole thing about oral tradition and dates of documents. If you're talking about when Ryan mentions dates, if he's talking about the relative chronology of, say, some Mesopotamian source versus, the biblical version of some story. Well, in many cases, those can be dated quite well and quite easily. So if it's a comparison between biblical material and Egyptian material or Mesopotamian material or Sumerian material, that isn't difficult to do. What we need to remember, though, is that some of that stuff, like Mesopotamian material, Mesopotamia has a long literary history. So you might have a flood story written in Sumerian that is older than the biblical material by a couple thousand years. But you could also have a flood story that's in the Mesopotamian group, the corpus there, that is contemporaneous with the biblical, the Israelite material. But yet, even though they're contemporaneous, that Mesopotamian text might actually borrow from the much earlier version of the Sumerian text. So this is where the whole dating issue gets a little fuzzy, because it's not like versions are produced that have no relationship to the earlier material when it comes to Mesopotamia. There are lots of flood stories that come from different eras of Mesopotamian history and literary output. A lot of it predates the biblical material. Some of it is contemporary. But even the contemporary stuff, again, is going to be drawing on much older material than the biblical stuff. Now, the Marduk, let's just say the flood story where Marduk is the centerpiece. Well, Marduk was the high god during the Babylonian era, and that's going to be contemporaneous with biblical material. So if you're a Mesopotamian, you know, Babylonian scribe, and you're creating your own version of your flood story or your creation story to elevate Marduk, yeah, you're going to be using earlier material, but you're also going to be doing contemporary tweaks that, again, if it's quote unquote new stuff, or really repurposing that really sort of telegraphs to the reader, or in this case the scholar, that hey, this line here or this idea here, was evidently, you know, composed during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, we'll say. Well, you know, then you can talk about a sort of contemporary sources for the story, biblical and Mesopotamian. It's just not a neat picture where you know, things don't get repurposed and don't get reused. But if you're talking about the civilizations, yeah, the Mesopotamian material and a lot of Egyptian material, you know, lots of this stuff are going to predate the biblical period, because we, in terms of manuscripts, the oldest manuscripts we have of the Hebrew Bible are the Dead Sea Scrolls. They go back to 200, maybe 300 BC. The oldest Hebrew anything written in Hebrew, anything that can be called Hebrew, and scholars would call it epigraphic Hebrew because these are like stone inscriptions. Epigraphic Hebrew goes back to the 10th century. That's still, by biblical chronology, 500 years after Moses. If you're talking about the alphabet, well, then you're pushing back into the biblical period, you know, when you have the Semitic alphabet invented, but there just isn't a lot of inscriptional material in the Semitic language we would call Hebrew that exists. You know, the 10th century, just think of 1000 BC, that's where you're at. And it's not biblical stuff. It's different kinds of inscriptions. When it comes to the biblical material, you know, we're dealing with the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it's really easy to look at the primary source data, the manuscripts we have, and say, in terms of literary output, what comes first? Okay, that's an easy call. It's an easy question. Ryan brought up the whole issue of oral tradition. Having said all that about the literary stuff, Israelites would have had in their experience, in their hearing, they would have had, you know, again, I believe, and I don't think it's a stretch at all, they would have had knowledge about the stories that wind up in the Bible, including Genesis 1 through 11. They would have been told stories about how, you know, the God of Israel created everything and created, you know, mankind. And they would have had stories about a flood, you know, and the confusion of the languages, the Tower of the Babel, the division of the nation. They would have had stories about this that get passed on, along with oral tradition about their own existence as a people. Now, the way biblical scholars typically look at this kind of thing is they'll say something like, well, at some point, you know, and it's an imprecise science to know at what point any particular part of this process would have been, you know, would have happened. But at some point, the oral tradition of the Israelites as a people, in other words, Abraham forward, because that's when Israel becomes a people, that is something that the average slave in Egypt would have heard. Their stories that their parents and their grandparents would have taught them. It's completely unreasonable to think that Israelites would have no origin story, and if they did, that they never would have talked about it. It's absurd. No culture in the history of the world does that. So that they're going to be talking about, you know, where they came from as a people and who their ancestors were and what their ancestors did. You're going to get stories about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and, you know, encountering God and, you know, covenants and all this sort of thing. They're going to have that knowledge, but it's not going to be codified. It's not going to be written down until much later. And that's where we get essentially Genesis 12 onward come from, you know, from those oral traditions. All the way up into, again, the Mosaic period, and then, you know, you start to be dealing with more contemporary events and whatnot. Genesis 1 through 11 is a bit of a different issue. I personally think, and I think, you know, if you're listening, you just heard me say this, that the core events, you know, of Genesis 1 through 11, Israelites are going to have stories, again, about creation, about a flood, about this or that, because frankly, every culture in the ancient Near East had these things. They have, you know, we like to say they have collective memories or a sort of institutional memory about these things. And they have, again, their own, other cultures are going to have their own beliefs about creation, obviously, but you're going to have certain events like a flood, you know, that you know, just become part of the institutional memory, the civilization memory of people. So Israelites are going to have that too. When it comes down to writing about that stuff, again, there's a lot in Genesis 1 through 11 that specifically responds to theologically, not only the theological religious claims and beliefs of Babylonians and other Mesopotamians and Egyptians for that matter. And, you know, you even get some stuff thrown in there that targets Canaanites, you know, the wider beliefs in Canaan. You're going to have a collection of chapters, you know, what we call Genesis 1 through 11, that I think, again, my view is that most of that is going to be composed later while Israel is in Babylon, specifically the outcome being a theological polemic against the gods of the nations and against the other, you know, religions, the other, you know, belief systems of the wider ancient Near East. You know, to do that, we're not just talking about, oh, they all had similar stories, and then Israel gets to sort of put right their own. In Genesis 1 to 11, you have specific connections in, again, the Hebrew text of Genesis 1 through 11 into literary stuff, into the actual documents of Mesopotamia and Egypt. There are specific connection points, specific things that scribes, you know, are trying to draw attention to and critique or attack or again, respond to in some way. But you're also going to have, you know, some overlap because of worldview, you know, common way of looking at the created world and life and so on and so forth. So it's going to be a mix. But the point is Genesis 1 through 11 has some really specific literary connections. And to do that, you got to have the literature. And the only place you're going to have that, again, is you're going to be living in a place where the literature is. And it's very logical that, you know, again, during the exile, you're going to have these texts available to you as a scribe, you know, someone who could read the material and interact with it, as opposed to, you know, Moses didn't drag around a portable library of clay tablets, you know, through the desert. You know, he didn't do that. Now, you could say, well, is it conceivable that, you know, in Egypt, they would have had, you know, some of this stuff? Sure, some of it. Sure, I think it's conceivable that they might have had exposure to, you know, maybe the epic, you know, epics of Mesopotamia. We don't really know that. There's not necessarily a lot of evidence for that. There is evidence that they could that the, you know, Egyptian scribes, and you would assume if you were Egyptian royalty, again, like Moses was, brought up in Pharaoh's household, that you could read some Akkadian, because you want to be able to do that for international correspondence. You don't want to get duped, you know, that kind of thing. So there could have been limited exposure to that sort of thing. So it's not completely off the table that someone like Moses might have been able to work in Akkadian, sure. But again, for what we're talking about goes beyond that. It there are very specific things in Genesis 1 through 11 that, since you have somebody sitting on this side of everything and has access to these languages and these texts, can look at the whole mass and say, okay, this writer is targeting this because he lifts this line or this phrase or uses this word. He brings a Sumerian word or something into, you know, the Hebrew language here. He borrows it again to you know, for the purpose of this, of telling the story, to get, you know, that detail, you know, right, or whatever the reason was. There are just things like that in Genesis 1 to 11 that have a heavy component from this other material. And so that's why scholars tend to look at Genesis 1 through 11 a little differently than they look at Genesis 12 from beyond. The whole point of the larger, you know, question is, do we believe that God was capable of picking people, many of whose names we will never know, of assembling this thing we call the Bible, the Torah in this case, or even the book of Genesis, whatever? Is God capable of equipping people for this task, providentially having them do this task, putting together through a combination of sources, polemic, and oral tradition, this thing we call the Torah? Is God capable of doing that or not? Again, this is why I always say we need to let the Bible be what it is. It is a useless, counterproductive, and you know, honestly, it makes the doctrine of inspiration vulnerable if we look at the Bible as the product of a cosmic mind dump or a paranormal event, because that is not what is reflected in the text itself. If we believe that the text is inspired, we'd look at the text. How was the text put together? Why do we need named authors? We don't. We need a God who is capable. We need a high view of providence. We need, again, some very simple, coherent theological ideas like this. Again, that they'll all extend from theism, God's existence and his ability to get something done, to prompt people to do things. That's what we need. That's what scripture is. You know, so back to the original, you know, the point where the question began, what about dates and all this stuff? Well, sometimes we can get a relative chronology. You know, where that looks like odds are things happen in this order. Sometimes you can do that. Sometimes you can do it with a high level of certainty. Other times, you know, you can't. And to be honest with you, at the end of the day, does it really matter? Well, in most cases, it really doesn't matter. And my preference is, you know, when you in graduate school, you know, have all these different fields of criticism, source criticism, you know, again, trying to chop scripture up into the original source documents. Well, the fact of the matter is those documents that scholars create are guesses. They're speculations. Same thing for, you know, historical criticism. What were the historical circumstances that led to all the pieces and led to the composition of the pieces? What was going on? Where did this idea come from? What's the history of this idea? They're speculation. What's not speculation is the thing that's sitting in front of you on the table, okay, or the manuscripts or whatever. We have manuscripts. You know, think of them as artifacts. They are things that exist in real time that can be looked at and handled and read and translated and so on and so forth. So my preference was always, I don't really care about spending my life on speculating how this thing in front of me came to being, came into being, you know, how it was put together. I don't really care. I know something happened in a combination of all these things. What I care about is now that I have it, now that I have this thing called, you know, the Bible, called, you know, the Tanakh, whatever it is, whatever portion or the whole, now that I have that in front of me, what does it mean? Okay, what does it say? What were the writers who put this thing together? What were they trying to communicate? I want to study the text as artifact, if you will, the final form of the text, because I believe that, you know, again, God was responsible ultimately for putting this thing together. It wasn't a cosmic mind dump. He used lots of people to produce this thing. They come from a specific culture, specific time periods. You know, there are things going on there. They may leave, you know, clues, you know, to chronology like that. They may not. But all I know is I have this thing in front of me now. So let's try the best that we can to read it as an ancient person would have been thinking, because an ancient person is the one who produced the thing, or the ones who produced the thing. So that's why I tend, you know, academically where I tended to land where I did, I wanted to be working in the final form of the text and try not to essentially spend every day speculating about where something came from. I'd rather deal with the thing that we have right here in front of us. And I don't think that it's contrary in any way to inspiration. Inspiration is a process, not an event.
All right. Our next question is from Scott, a Minnesotan in China, Thailand. And his question is, in the New Testament, when Jesus enters a room and says, "Peace be with you," we know he is really speaking Aramaic and saying Shalom, or the Aramaic equivalent. And then it is rendered in Greek as the gospel writers recount the event. How much of the New Testament can we think of this way?
Well, I would say, to be honest, we really don't know if Jesus was speaking Aramaic. I mean, it depends on who's in the room. If Jesus walked into a room of Hellenistic Jews or a room with a mixed composition, Jews and Gentiles, he may have spoken Greek. I mean, we just don't know for sure what the scene was at any given point. You know, who, even if we have a scene in the Gospels, do we have a head count? You know, do we have an ethnicity count? Well, no. Sometimes we get more of an indication than others. But I mean, Jesus is part of a multilingual culture. And in a multilingual culture like, you know, first century Judea, we can't really assume what anyone is saying at any given point is in this or that language. We can go with the odds, so to speak. So if Jesus walked in a room full of Jews from his hometown or part of Judea dominated by a Jewish presence, well, Aramaic's a pretty good bet. But if the parameters change, well, it could have done something else. You know, incidentally, Jesus, getting off into the Aramaic thing for a little bit here, Jesus isn't recorded as using Aramaic except in only a few places. There's Mark chapter 5, there's one in Mark 7. Some of these are parallel in Matthew. There's one in Mark 15. There are people, you know, who have studied this Jeremias. I always get his, I don't even know if it's Jeremias or Jeremias, but I think it's Jeremias, a New Testament scholar, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. He had roughly a couple dozen Aramaic words in the Gospels in total. So that isn't a whole lot. There are still scholars today who would suspect or argue that instead of Aramaic as being the native tongue of Jesus, it might have been Mishnaic Hebrew. That's possible. For those who are interested in this, I'm going to post a few articles on this. I've collected some, and I'll pick out a few here from what I have. If you subscribe to the newsletter, again, you'll be given a link in each issue of the newsletter. At the bottom, there's a link to a protected folder where I can put articles that aren't publicly accessible, so that newsletter subscribers can at least, you know, read them. But there's one by, I'm looking at a list here, one by Stanley Porter. Did Jesus ever teach in Greek? It's from Tyndale Bulletin in 1993. Now, what Porter argues in this is, yeah, he could have taught in Greek. Porter acknowledges this is kind of a minority view. Most other scholars would sort of give Jesus fluency in Aramaic or Mishnaic Hebrew, but Porter thinks he would have been trilingual. But, you know, he spends 30 pages, you know, laying out his case that Jesus could have taught in Greek too. There's one by Grintz, Hebrew as the spoken and written language in the last days of the Second Temple. Another by Emerton, the problem of vernacular Hebrew in the first century AD in the language of Jesus. So these are going to get into Jesus being an Aramaic speaker, Mishnaic Hebrew speaker. Again, it's not unreasonable to think that Jesus could have been trilingual. And so we can't really assume much about Jesus walks into a room and says, okay, you know, like which language he's using. You'd have to know about the context. If the context is like really, really, really distinctly Jewish, well, again, Aramaic could be a good bet, but he, you know, if we could time travel, we might have heard Jesus speak in Hebrew, you know, Mishnaic Hebrew. We don't know. So I wouldn't base any sort of exegetical or theological conclusions necessarily on some of these assumptions. I think we need to try to think about all the possibilities, you know, when it comes to this. So it's really hard to kind of reimagine what, you know, not only what Jesus or anybody else would have been, you know, speaking or doing, but when it comes to literary output, you know, that's a whole different issue. So I think it makes very little sense to have much more than Matthew and Mark, we'll say, two of the Gospels, possibly written in Aramaic originally. You know, this whole discussion takes us into the Aramaic New Testament issue, so I might as well say something about that here. There is no evidence that the Aramaic, no manuscript evidence that the New Testament, any portion of it, was written in Aramaic. There are some who argue for that. Again, Mark and Matthew usually become the target for that. Certainly Luke was not. Luke was a Gentile. He's writing to a Gentile. Why would he write in Aramaic? Paul's epistles are written to predominantly Gentile churches. Why would he write in Aramaic? Hey, I'm going to write you a letter, but I want half the congregation to not be able to read it. Doesn't make any sense. You know, John is much later. He lacks Hebraisms in many cases like Matthew. He has little to no literary dependence on Matthew and Mark. Again, if you're familiar with the synoptic debate, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you know, who wrote first and the other two are dependent on that one. John is not in the synoptics for a reason. Most of the content in John is not in the other three. So he doesn't have a literary dependence on the synoptics. So again, that would suggest anyway that even if Matthew or Mark were written in Aramaic originally, John doesn't really care. You know, he comes later. He's not interested in tracking on that material. So Aramaic doesn't really make much sense for John and what he writes. Maybe the Targum, you know, maybe he might have used some Targums or been influenced by Targums, like in the word theology. In the beginning was the word. You know, we've talked about this a little bit on the podcast before in relationship to the two powers in heaven idea. Where does John get that? Well, he gets it from his Old Testament, and he may have been, you know, familiar with the Memra material, Aramaic Targums of the Old Testament, where you have the second Yahweh figure, Memra, the word. Memra is the Aramaic word for word, where you have the word of God inserted into certain passages. He may have been familiar with that, so there may be an Aramaic influence there with John, but there's no reason to believe that the gospel or Revelation, you know, were written in Aramaic. Revelation, in fact, is oriented to Asia Minor. Churches in the first few chapters, again, this is predominantly Gentile. It's Gentile territory, predominantly Gentile churches. Why would you write in Aramaic? Even the general epistles that are aimed at Jews in the dispersion. Well, where's the dispersion? It's out in the Gentile world. So you're gonna have letters. Yeah, they're written to a Jewish audience, but chances are they're going to get passed around among groups of believers, many of whom are Gentiles. It just makes no sense to have an Aramaic New Testament is what I'm getting at. Again, maybe Matthew, maybe Mark, maybe an early gospel, something like that. But even if it makes sense for those, you know, two books, we don't actually have any manuscript evidence for it. So I'm not really sure why, in my own mind, why people, you know, and I'm not saying that this is the case, you know, for Scott, but I've met some people, you know, in the course of being online, that, you know, really, really care, and I think to an unusual degree about Jesus speaking in Aramaic, and the Aramaic being the language of the New Testament. I really don't see what the concern is. But again, I don't really read that in Scott's question. I think this is coming from curiosity, not some sort of ideology. But I've met people again who are in the latter camp, and it just doesn't make any sense to have an Aramaic New Testament. So I don't think we need to get hung up on at least that part of the question.
Okay, Dana has a question about Numbers 4, verse 5 through 6 in the New American Standard Bible. A porpoise skin is unclean. I'm surprised it's used to cover the Ark of the Covenant. After more research, the Hebrew takash says fine leather. It's not animal specific. Why would Hebrew scholars choose this as an acceptable translation?
Well, they would choose that because the meaning of porpoise skin is nothing more than a conjecture. I mean, the takash here, to try to make this succinct, and some of these things don't really translate well to being verbal on a podcast, but I'll take a stab at this. This word, this Hebrew lemma, has, for many scholars, they've argued that it has an Akkadian background, and ultimately, therefore, a Sumerian background. Now, ESV renders it goat skin. Again, Dana mentioned animal skin. Some other scholars, like Milgram in his commentary, opt for yellow orange, like a color, as the meaning of takash. And both the color and the sort of neutral animal skin idea really comes from the assumed etymology, the assumed bringing in of this word from the outside, Akkadian and Sumerian, into the Hebrew lexicon. Here's how it goes. There is a term, dushu, okay, and that refers to a stone of a certain color. And so, again, you have to have a little bit of Semitic language background here. You say, well, what dushu doesn't sound like takash. Well, that's true. But you can have a word in one language that doesn't have all of the consonantal similarities in another language still speak of the same object. I mean, we have this today in modern languages, and it often works that way in the ancient world. Every Akkadian word, for instance, doesn't share the same consonants as every Hebrew word. Akkadian is Semitic, Hebrew is Semitic, but Akkadian's Eastern. Hebrew is Northwest Semitic. They're different. There's geography to it. There's different language groups and dialects and subgroups and all this sort of stuff. The reason why this seems like a good correlation is you have dushu, and that comes from Sumerian du-shi-a. That is alignable to a Hurrian word, tuk-sive. So now you're getting into the takash sort of phonological neighborhood. So by virtue of Akkadian and Hurrian, this one would be like the Nuzi dialect is Hurrian. You may have heard of the Nuzi tablets when it comes to the patriarchs. Because Hurrian and Akkadian sources align these two things, Dushu and Tuksive, okay? Because they align those terms to speak of the same thing, scholars take that, they notice the correlation with the Hurrian dialect. And they say, okay, well, that sounds a lot like takash, and let's go look and see what that meant in Akkadian. And in Akkadian, it referred to a stone of a particular color. And so some scholars would argue that takash refers to the particular color that resulted from dyeing leather. There you get your animal skin idea. Dyeing leather in the culture. Now, you notice in all of that, we didn't say anything about dolphins or porpoises. I don't know of anybody who would really defend that idea, the whole porpoise skin, that it probably, I hate to put it this way, but it probably comes from older English translations or traditions about the translation. However, to be fair, Levine, I've looked this up in Levine's Numbers commentary, and he says that, quote, dolphin skins were used quite extensively in the ancient Near East and in certain cults. That's what he says. He doesn't ever say that this term means that, but he happens to discuss that at one point in his commentary. So we don't really know why porpoise skin or dolphin skin would be an acceptable translation here etymologically. Again, if you're doing the comparative Semitic vocabulary, it seems that a better option is either to translate it as the thing being dyed, i.e. the animal skin, or the color that results. And so that's where you're going to find most commentators land, again, because of Akkadian and Sumerian and the Hurrian linguistic evidence. So again, having said all of that, I can't find any passage where this lemma, takash, occurs in a description of something unclean. Takash doesn't occur in Leviticus at all, for example. So I don't really know why the unclean element is part of the conversation. Maybe if under the assumption that we're dealing with a porpoise skin and that relates to some other animal group, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't want to sit here and search through everything. That makes for a really boring podcast. But again, a quick search of the lemma, it doesn't occur in any passage that names unclean things. So I'm not really sure why. Again, that's part of the question, but I thought I'd throw that out there. You know, maybe some people thought it was unclean because, again, Near Eastern cults use dolphin skins, and then they just made that correlation. Okay, well, I could see how you would get there then. But the fact of the matter is, if you actually look up this lemma's usage in the Hebrew Bible, it doesn't occur in passages that list that. I mean, maybe it has a homograph. I don't know at this point. But again, from what I do know, you know, just fielding the question, that's how I would answer it.
Marion's question is about Genesis 15, verse 16. What does it mean that in iniquity of the Amorites is not complete? What does complete mean? Is God waiting until a certain amount of time has passed or until the iniquity has reached a point where he will no longer allow it to continue? It almost sounds as if the Amorites have the protection of the unseen realm with a prior agreement that they could sin up to a certain point in time.
Yeah, I would think that's reading a lot into the last part there, is reading a lot into the passage. There's certainly nothing in this passage or in any other passage that indicates that God sort of just winks at sin or you know, apostasy or whatever, like there's a quota to fulfill before he gets angry. There's nothing like that. But I understand the trajectory, though. I think to start off, it's good to remind ourselves that Amorites is a generic term in some cases, in some contexts, and I would make it part of this context relating to giant clans. I wrote about this in Unseen Realm, where there are, you know, places in Joshua, like Joshua chapter 7, I think it's around verse 7, referred to the occupants of the land as Amorites. You certainly get that in Amos 2, 9 through 10, referring to those who were, you know, driven out, and also specifically the ones who were very tall as Amorites. That's important because it's abundantly clear that there are other ethnic groups in the land. You got Perizzites, Hittites, Hivites, you know, all that whole list. But the Amorites is sort of this, again, in certain contexts, this umbrella term for the giant clans. So I think that's important to sort of have running in the background when we think about this. I actually think there are two options here, neither of which is about, again, what I would loosely refer to here, just for the sake of the question, as sort of a sin quota or an evilness, if that's even a word, quota. Option number one, I think the easiest parsing of the comment is that it's an expression that means something like, it's not yet time to punish the Amorites. Okay, for whatever reason, we wouldn't be given a reason. Not that, hey, they're not quite wicked enough for me to get angry about them. I don't think that's the point. I think it's God has his own, you know, reasoning, his own timing, which may factor into the second option here. But I think, you know, just looking at it, like it's not yet time to punish the Amorites. I've not decided yet to act on the Amorites. Now, you could also read it, though, that God's judgment of the Amorites wouldn't necessarily wait until the conquest that we think of under Moses and Joshua, but God was about to initiate it, and it would take a long time. But Abraham's seed, because since he's talking to Abraham, Genesis 15, Abraham's seed would be the one, the vehicle through which the Amorites would ultimately be judged, but it would occur over a long period of time. So the second option, I guess I could put it this way. You could argue that it means the Amorites haven't yet been fully punished for their iniquity, or that their punishment is about to be launched and will be in process for a long time. Now, that option would presume, again, as I write about an unseen realm in the discussion of Og's bed, that option would presume that Amorite is sort of a conceptual play on Babylonian, or the idea that Babylon was the source of evil and chaos. And you get there because Mar-2, M-A-R.T-U in Sumerian, all caps, Mar-2, which was their word for Amorite, it actually, you know, there's a Sumerian term here at the base of Amorite, is what I'm trying to say here. And Mar-2 is the Sumerian word. Mar-2 in Sumerian vaguely refers to the Aryan population west of Sumer and, you know, and Babylon, sort of that general area. So since that was the term there, maybe Amorite comes from Mar-2, and then that links the Amorites to the Babylonian part of the world. And once you do that, the whole Babylonian complex of ideas in scripture, especially Genesis 1 through 11. So, you know, why is the world, you know, so messed up? Well, there, as I've said many times here, there are three reasons for that. It's the fall, Genesis 6, and then the Babel event. Well, the Genesis 6 event and the Babel event, if anybody's read Unseen Realm, and especially if you've read Reversing Hermon, you know that episodes 2 and 3 are deeply entrenched in this idea of Babylon as the source of everything that is contrary to the way the God of the Bible wants it to be. And so there could be this thing going on with the term Amorite. So you might have this, you know, in play that God is about to act. They haven't yet been, you know, punished for their iniquity, but hey, it's right around the corner in terms of, you know, God's perspective, because he doesn't really care about time. But he's going to raise up the mechanism for punishment through Abraham and his seed. And that's ultimately what happens in the biblical story. So now we know, to add another layer here, we know from Deuteronomy 2 and 3 that the punishment of the giant clans was an ongoing process, okay, involving Abraham's descendants, Abraham's seed versus the giant clans. We know that because if we read Deuteronomy 2 and 3, it's the descendants of Esau that were used to get rid of the giants in the Transjordan, at least most of them. You know, Og of Bashan is still left, and of course Moses and Joshua are going to take care of business there. But in the process, you know, you've had other descendants of Abraham actually being the agents to address the Amorites. And so maybe when God, you know, speaks to Abraham in this way, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full, you know, he could either be saying sort of a little bit neutrally, hey, it's not yet time to punish them. We'll get to that. Or some idea that, well, they haven't been fully punished yet, you know, for their iniquity, but we're about to start that ball rolling. So one, there's a bit of a time differential between the two options, but in neither case is it about the Amorites sort of meeting some bar of evilness, you know, some bar of iniquity, so that now they're punishment eligible. They're punishment eligible long before they get what's coming to them. So again, I don't think that's the point. I think that the point is something about either God's timing, or again, the amount of time, the process through which the Amorites would be judged.
Travis has a question, and it is, do you have a view on the eternal functional subordination debate? It seems like an area dominated by New Testament scholars, but I would think the eternal part would have to draw on the revelation of the Godhead prior to the incarnation. So I wonder what you think in light of your work on the two powers idea.
Well, you know, this one's a little hard for me to care about. So I think Travis's suspicion, you know, I read a little bit into this. You know, do I have a view on it? You know, both sides of this are not going to deny the eternality in terms of ontology of the persons of the Trinity. So I don't really care if the subordination of the Son and Spirit are eternal or temporary. Again, the subordination, because I don't think a subordinate relationship detracts from the essence or the ontology of the Spirit or the Son. And frankly, I don't really consider any arguments to that effect to be at all persuasive. Subordination is really about role relationships between the persons of the Trinity. It's not about essence or ontology. Now, you know, I'll try to use an analogy here, and all analogies are imperfect because we're talking about deity and a godhead. So bear with me here. But if you had three human clones created from scratch, as it were, they could have a hierarchical relationship between them, but they'd all be fully human and they'd all have the same DNA. In other words, the roles that each one took wouldn't make one of them ontologically inferior to any of the other ones. And this is how I view the whole thing with the Trinity. I think there's a theological problem if you have a difference of ontology. You know, ontology, again, is what a thing is, okay? If you had a difference of ontology between the persons, if you were talking like that, well, then I have a problem with that because you can't really have degrees of deity. You know, the persons are either the same in essence or they're not. But that's ontology. Again, subordination is really about how they relate to each other. So again, I don't really compare if their relationship to each other is something that grows out of eternity or it was temporary. You know, I can't really say it any other way. I don't really care too much about the debate. Ultimately, I don't think it's something we can know for sure. We're only going to find out about that later with any, you know, any precision. So I don't really spend a whole lot of time kind of, you know, skinning that cat, to be honest with you.
Daryl from Newton, Mississippi has two questions. And his first one is, I heard Dr. Heiser mention that the earth was populated with other people while Adam and Eve were in the garden. Could you please elaborate on that?
Well, Dr. Heiser doesn't claim that. What I claim is that this is one way that you could read certain passages in Genesis. I don't really feel compelled one way or the other. Again, it's just this or that passage could be read to, it could be read as evidence that there were other people besides Adam and Eve. But again, there are ways to read the same passages that, you know, would sort of get around that or explain the language. So I'm not gonna be married, you know, to the views, but you know, we want to be honest about what the text says and how it could be read. So, you know, with that sort of setup, you know, this gets us into there are really two views of this. There's pre-Adamism, that there were humans around before Adam that were, you know, precursors. And then there's co-Adamism. You know, there are humans alongside of Adam and Eve. Co-Adamism, I don't know, it might be easier to argue than the other one, but it's all based on circumstantial evidence anyway. Either view is circumstantial evidence. And circumstantial evidence isn't exegesis. But again, the text could be read in certain ways. And I'll try to illustrate that. So the argument for other people besides Adam and Eve, let's leave the pre and the co, you know, out as much as we can just to simplify. The argument for other people besides Adam and Eve, you know, being part of the biblical story or part of the biblical world, let's put it that way, it at the same time period of Adam and Eve really operates on two trajectories. One is there are passages that suggest there were other people besides Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel. Again, suggest is the operative word. They don't state it, but they can be read to suggest that. Now, I say Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel because those are the only two children we're told that Adam and Eve had up until, of course, Abel is murdered, then he's replaced by Seth. So we're really only told about Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, and those two lineages. Okay, that's who we know about in the early chapters of Genesis. Nevertheless, we read stuff like this. Okay, here's Genesis 4, 14 through 17. Again, this is the Cain and Abel story. And this is after Cain has killed Abel. We read in verse 14, "Behold," you know, Cain is speaking to God, "Behold, you have driven me away today from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Whoever finds me will kill me. Cain's expecting that somebody might find him. Well, where did they come from? Verse 15, "Then the Lord said to him, not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him," what, 1,000 years later, 500 years later, 100 years later? I mean, it seems like when God puts a mark on Cain to protect him, that the protection is needed right then. So the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain knew his wife, well, where'd she come from? And she conceived and bore Enoch. When he built a city, you know, when Cain built a city, again, we read that for the sake of our discussion here, as Cain, when Cain built a city, what, did he build it by himself? How could one guy build a city? Or maybe Enoch helps. So now there's two guys. Maybe his son helps. So they have two people building a city. I mean, it seems like to build a city or even a decent sized town or a village that you'd need help. So when he built a city, he called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. So in verses 14 through 17, you've got several, again, suggestions, again, ways that the things in the text that can be read as though they just assume that there are other people around. It continues. If you keep reading in Genesis 4, you hit verse 25. Okay, listen to this one. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. Verse 26. So to Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. So now who do we have? We've got Adam, Eve, we've got Cain, we've got Seth replacing Abel, and then Seth has a son, Enosh. So we've got five people. So at that time, ESV has, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. Now that raises a question of why would the verse be translated that way? Because when you translated people, it begs the question of, well, why not just say at that time they began to call on the name of the Lord, which of course begs another question, like who have they been calling on before? Why not just say they began, or why not just be, you know, said Adam and Eve and their children began to call on the name of the Lord? Now, if you actually look at the text, the translation of people actually derives from a kind of an uncertainty as to what to do with the Hebrew text, because you essentially have a word for at that time, Oz in Hebrew. So at that time, and then you have began to call. And the word translated began is third masculine singular. So you could translate this a couple of different ways. You could say he began, but that doesn't really, again, make sense, because which one? You know, who began to call on the name of the Lord? But even though you could translate it that way, a corporate translation implies, again, that everybody in the group began to call on the name of the Lord. And you can say, again, if you want to deny that there are other people around besides these five people, you'd say, well, that's the way you should translate it. They began to call on the name of the Lord, these five people here. Okay, you could do that. But some would object and say, well, didn't they have a relationship with God already? It seems to suggest, at least to the mind of some, that they, again, some other collective group, began to call the name of the Lord. Like it's an observation that sort of marks out other people besides the family of Adam and Eve, whom we would assume are already doing this. So there's ambiguity in the text, and frankly, that's just what you get with the whole thing. So we read, again, a couple of instances here just to try to summarize. We read Genesis 4, 14 through 17, then 25 through 26. And so some people look at these passages and they ask the questions that I've vocalized, that I've mouthed here as we proceed through the translation. And they would argue that, look, the wording here suggests that there's somebody else around besides Adam and Eve and their kids. You know, so again, it's suggestive, it's speculative, it's not exegesis. It's circumstantial evidence. It's things that are there in the text that could be read a certain way. So, honestly, that's about the best you can do here. But there are some who would look at the text and say, "Well, I think we ought to read it this way because of, you know, some other thought, some other issue, some other thing." You know, and one of those things, as I've put on the blog, could be the whole discussion of human evolution and genetics and DNA statistics and all this kind of stuff that we did this series a few years ago about the historical Adam and that whole debate, and, you know, statistical genetics and so on and so forth. That discussion in some cases prompts people to look at these passages and say, well, you know, the scripture actually could be read in such a way. I mean, legitimately, I mean, you could read it as assuming that there are other people there. And then that becomes, you know, your touch point for addressing some of these maybe scientific concerns or whatnot. Again, you're still making a text-based argument. You're just going with, again, a reading of the text that could be possible, but, you know, the other side, you know, could, you know, just as well turn around and say, no, we shouldn't, you know, look at the verse this way. Okay. That's one trajectory, these kind of verses. The second trajectory on which this idea is based on might sound a little more arcane, but I think there is something to this. I don't know if it means that there were other people on earth besides Adam and Eve, although the implication is that it could point us in that direction. And that is Adam a deliberate analogy to Israel? Okay, are Adam and Israel in the biblical story designed? Are these stories told in such a way that we are supposed to draw a link between Adam and Israel? We're supposed to think of one when we think of the other. So the way this goes, and we actually did, I'm trying to remember, I don't think we did an episode on this. I think I blogged about it. I talked about Seth Postel's work, Adam as Israel. Now Seth does not believe that there were other humans other than Adam and Eve, but his book actually draws attention to the number of correlations between the way Adam is described in his part of the biblical story and the way Israel is described in its part of the story. Both are, for instance, the Son of God. Both are raised up supernaturally. Okay, you get the idea. You're trying to draw analogies, points of correlation between the two. So was, you know, as Israel was a people selected out of all the other people on earth to be God's people, and that's not quite a good statement because Israel's actually produced supernaturally through Abraham and Sarah, but Israel becomes elect. They become the body of humanity, the subset of humanity that becomes God's people. They're elect. They're chosen from among all other peoples. God could have chosen people who already existed, but instead he creates anew. He creates Israel from Abraham and Sarah. And some people would say, well, that's just like what he does with Adam, at least possibly. There could have been other humans around. Look at Genesis 4. And so God just decides to pick Adam as his son, choose Adam as his son and his line as his people. And then that line, of course, becomes part of the people he would select later. There's a lineage that leads to Abraham. And of course, Abraham is the progenitor of Israel. So as Israel was a people selected out of all other people on earth to be God's people, is it the same with Adam? Is he selected out of a larger group? Again, there are people who make literary cases and good ones. I mean, these are good text-based cases for conceptual and literary links between the portraits of Adam and Israel. And so the question becomes, the second trajectory is, well, if that's the case, if we're supposed to think of one and then think of the other, and if we really kind of press the analogy that there were other humans around, certainly when Israel was created, could we presume the same thing of Adam, that there were other humans around? You know, and so God picks Adam, and then the biblical story becomes about this one person and his wife and their children. Again, who knows? These are arguments by circumstantial evidence and suggestion. It's not that you could do exegesis and really, you know, build a very strong argument for that idea and that cancels out the other ones. You can't really do that. But again, to be fair, there are things in the text that if you approach them a certain way, you could come out with this view.
Timothy's second question and the last question of the episode is, can you explain 1 Timothy 2, verse 10 through 15?
No, not in a Q&A. You know, this whole passage, this is about women, you know, not teaching and being silent and, you know, in church. This is, of course, the passage is related to the larger women in ministry, you know, women in the church issue. Honestly, you can argue both sides pretty well from the text. Now, for people who have sort of followed my website, my blog for any amount of time. Years ago, I did a blog series on the Women in Ministry issue with John Hobbins. John and his wife are both pastors. And so I told John, you know, I wanted to do this. And I said, your job is to make me care about the issue. Because again, my view is this is so far down my list of things to really care about because I see ambiguity in the text at key points. And that is what allows us to argue both sides well from the text. So I said, John, if you can make me care, it make me feel like I need to like land somewhere and then diss the other side, go ahead. But he failed. I still feel the same way about it, but it was fun. Again, I tend to not get terribly invested in issues where positions get stalled in textual ambiguity. To me, they become, by definition, issues of conscience. And that's really, for instance, what I would tell my daughter if I had my daughter come up to me and say, hey, I feel God is calling me into the ministry. I would say, well, you know, that's between you and the Lord. I can't honestly, you know, say that I'm sure you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. I don't know. But do well and be a blessing. That's exactly what I would tell my daughter. Do the best you can. Be a blessing. You know, have a good ministry. This is between you and the Lord. So when it comes to 1 Timothy 2, I mean, this little subset of the women in ministry issue, the passage itself has a few workable possibilities, some that might seem better than others, but there's no one view that renders all of the other possibilities fundamentally incoherent and indefensible. So again, you're dealing with a difficult passage that has certain ambiguities about what's in the text. Now, to illustrate, I'll make one exegetical observation about 1 Timothy 2, 10 through 15, and I'll use that as a basis for a position. In other words, I'm going to pretend here. This is a thought experiment for the sake of the question of the podcast. So I could look at the passage and say, well, you know, Paul, in this passage, really makes his judgment deeply personal. He says, you know, let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. For Adam was first formed, then Eve. Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. You know, if we go back into the passage, you know, again, just looking at that, it looks like, you know, when he says, I do not permit, it looks like Paul is making a personal argument. And the exegetical point is that, you know, Paul uses the first person. I wouldn't do X, Y, or Z. And I could interpret that and say, well, you know, that means his advice may be just that, a personal preference based on the rationale that he gives about Genesis. But, you know, Paul conveniently leaves out that the man sinned willfully. He's concerned that the woman, you know, was deceived and not the man. But what he leaves out the fact that Adam sinned with a high hand, so to speak. He sinned with full knowledge. So if Paul's point is that women shouldn't teach because they fall victim to false teaching more than men, why not flip it around and say men are more dangerous to have as teachers because they can turn around and deceive people deliberately? Well, he doesn't do that. The fact that Paul leaves something so obvious out of the discussion suggests to me that this is a personal preference born of some situation that influenced his thinking. Or perhaps it's the familiar model of Judaism. He was a Pharisee and all that. At any rate, I could argue that the passage can be read as 1 Corinthians 7, for example, is read, where Paul just tells people where he's at. Hey, you know, I wish that you were all like me, or you know, I'm going to give my judgment on this. He's trying to give good advice for reasons that may not make complete sense to us, but did make sense to him and others because they were living at a certain, you know, in a certain context there at Corinth or here with Timothy. We may not be aware of every reason that prompted Paul to say what he said, but my exegetical observation is here. He uses the first person, which means he's giving personal advice. Now, I can do that all day long. I can take some other point of the passage and argue for a totally different view. And this is the problem with 1 Timothy 2. It's the problem with the women in ministry issue. At any given point, I could argue either side of these questions pretty clearly and pretty effectively, again, using the text as my touch point. not caring about gender issues, feminine issues, this or that group, this or that ministry that takes this or that position. Don't care about any of that. Again, the question is what can the text sustain? And depending on what you emphasize in your exegesis, you can come down at different points and still build an exegetical argument on either side. And for those who are interested in this, you can go back and look at the exchange between myself and John. Again, his job was not to convert me. His job was to make me care enough about taking a position. And like I said, he failed, but it was fun. I can't say it any other way. I really don't feel that it's a good use of my time, and that I should really be pontificating too heavily on an issue that really there's in this one there's three or four points, there's three or four passages that will make the issue turn in one direction or the other. And the honest thing to say is that it could go either way because there's ambiguity built up in the text. It's just there. You'd have to be omniscient to really sort this one out. That's the most honest thing I can say. If you want to use the prophecy thing as an analogy, like the rapture, are you a splitter or a joiner? When it comes to descriptions of the Lord's return, should we put them in two piles or one? You put them in two piles, you have a rapture and a second coming. You put them in one, you got one event. Which one is the right answer? I don't know. I just don't know. I can build an argument for either one and have it look wonderful and elegant. But at the end of the day, I have to tell you that I am landing here because I just decided to emphasize this over that. And that's what you got with the women in issue. It's what you have with 1 Timothy 2. And by the way, we didn't even get to the last part of the passage, the whole thing about she shall be saved through childbearing. That's a whole separate issue. This passage would take a whole, I would say probably two or three episodes of the podcast to just sort of navigate the waters, through this passage. And of course, since this is 1 Timothy 2, the whole wider issue of, how you'd argue, the women's issue in either direction. That would take probably three podcast episodes. But for those of you who that might sound like good news, I would say don't expect that anytime soon, because we are about to start into a new book study. And again, I care about that, honestly, the book study more than I care about, this issue. At least that's where I'm at right now.
All right, Mike. Well, that's it. Maybe in the future, 1 Timothy will come up as a voting option where we can devote some time on that, huh?
No? Yeah, or we could just leave it off the list, right?
Okay.
We can make sure that never gets on the
list. There you go. And in fact, what is it? If we covered all the books, it would take us, like 60-something years. So expect it within the next century, I guess.
Yeah.
But
Who knows?
All right, Mike. Well, just like that, we can end it. Just want to thank you again for answering our questions. And I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.